Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and join us in the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. If you have any questions or observations you want to share, or you just want to put a direct question there to one of our guests, feel free to hop in there. Eagle One will be riding herd on the chat room, and we'll do the best to fold in those contributions as we go along. And if you're new to Midrats, or if you wanted to catch up on other shows, or as a lot of y'all have learned, if we go long, you can always catch what happens after the show stops up on the archive on Blog Talk Radio or via iTunes if you want to go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. Now let's get on to the show. Our first guest really should be known to everybody here. Eagle One and I, we started our blog and blogosphere presence back in 2004, and shortly after that, in February 2005, the illustrious Skippy-san of Far East Cynic, he came on board the blogosphere, and everybody has been bouncing around the Navy realm should definitely be familiar with him. But in addition to all those things that Skippy pontificates about, one of the things that has always made Skippy a go-to person is when you're dealing with Japan. Though a lot of his things are tongue-in-cheek, you always can see there's a lot of affection for Japan, the Japanese people, and the Japanese culture. And you know, today we're not going to worry about what's going on in Libya. We want to, first of all, talk about Japan and when they had the earthquake, tsunami, and then the ongoing problems with their nuclear reactors. Skippy came to mind, and I think it was a great opportunity to bring him on board and to let him answer some of our questions and talk some about Japan. And Skippy, thank you very much for last coming on Midrats. Welcome aboard.
Okay. Thanks.
Glad to have you. And starting off, you don't just have a secondary issue and concern with Japan. It also is very close home to you and your family. If you could please give the listeners a background on your connection to Japan and some of your observations that you've had about what we've seen in the last few weeks.
Okay, sure. I think everybody knows, I spent almost 9 years in Japan. I went over there in March of 2000, and that's where I met my significant other. And so she has relatives that actually her mother and her brother live in Fukushima Prefecture, which is they live in the western part of the prefecture on the mountains in the foothills. But there's a big mountain range over there, and it's real pretty. And they, her mom has lived there probably for about 25 years now. But her father was in the Rikujo Jietai, which is the Japanese Grounds of Self-Defense Forces. So she moved around. So she was born in Sapporo, and then she grew up in Sendai, so she considers Sendai her home, the same way I consider Pittsburgh my home, even though I wasn't born in Pittsburgh. I was born in Tennessee. So she's got definitely a connection to that region, which they call in Japanese, it's called the Tohoku region, which is the northern part of Honshu. And so she's very familiar with it. Sendai is old stomping grounds for her, and so she has been watching the coverage like everybody has and been trying to get as much Japanese language coverage, which if I could point out, it might be worth something to talk about. There is a big difference between what CNN and the American networks are talking about and the way that NHK has covered, the way the Japanese covered it. I mean, the Japanese coverage has been dealing with the nuclear power plant, but it's not dealing with it obsessively, I guess is probably the best way that I can put it.
Why do you think that is? It almost seems that the American networks have been trying to make a domestic energy policy political issue out of it. Is it because the Japanese know that because of their energy situation, the nuclear power is something they just can't wish away?
Well, I think it's mostly, I think it's just based on that. People have family up there. People have friends. They have. Can you still hear me?
Sure can.
My phone. Okay. I didn't know if my phone had kicked out. But, you know, I think it's that's just more basic. They have friends and family in the region. People, you know, Tokyo, most people from Tokyo don't come from Tokyo to begin with. They come from out in the country, and then they come there to work, or they come there for university, and they end up staying. I mean, that's how the SO, she did it. She came down to Tokyo Women's College when she was in her early 20s, and then she went to work for a Japanese company and then an American company, and so she stayed. But to her, Tokyo is not home. Tokyo is just where she lived, even though she's, you know, spent more of her life in Tokyo than she has anywhere else. So I think that's more that people are trying to make that connection to the human piece of the tragedy, which is just the sheer level of destruction that came from the tsunami and what it did. And so that's been interesting to watch. Like I said before the intro, we were able to get live streaming NHK, and then kind of the link, for whatever reason, has gone dead. All we can get now is the English language broadcast from NHK World. And I'm not sure why NHK stopped that.
Well, what do you see, or what do you understand the differences to be between the way the Japanese are reporting this and the way the international press seems to have been until Libya blew up, making this into a Chicken Little thing where they ignore that the 15 or so thousand people that seem to be killed, but it's all about nuclear reactors and nuclear problems 24/7, at least, as I say, until Libya blew up. What is going on as far as the Japanese reporting of what's happening?
Well, I think you're seeing, or at least you did see, a lot more of the stuff that I saw was where they'd show like the one they had a couple days ago where somebody was rescued after 8 days in the wreckage. And they have the same kind of thing where they had, you know, they show where people are going through or like trying to get clean away the mud, or also, you know, bringing the supplies and those kind of things. And that's what I would say is missing, at least while I've been on a business trip this week. And so whenever I turn on the news, of course, all I was seeing was just basically everything talking about Fukushima and its you know, nuclear and its reactor problems. And so, you know, one of the things that she keyed on, too, was there's some pretty, I don't know if you've ever heard of Ishihara-san. He's the governor of Tokyo. And he said some pretty ugly things that got a lot of people upset, basically because he called the tsunami judgment on Japan. And she said, and you can read it on my blog, that, you know, she was really angry at him for doing that. And she figured that he should apologize for it, which I think he later did.
Wow, that's pretty, that's an unimpressive thing for a politician to do. The one of the things that caught my attention as a Southerner, I always took a lot of umbrage on some of the things that were said after Hurricane Katrina hit us. But the one thing that nobody could talk around was the fact that whether it's somebody winning an NBA championship or a huge storm hits a big city, Americans can loot and riot like champs at the drop of a hat. But though I'm sure there may have been, you know, isolated incidents, with the large amount of civil disruption you had in Japan, you just did not see looting, large-scale problems of that respect. Is there something in the Japanese culture that perhaps we could, if not adopt, at least try to understand, that could inform why the Japanese civil society reacted the way they did? Or are we just not hearing what went on afterwards?
Well, I think, you know, for one thing, there is crime in Japan. I mean, there probably has been a lot of that, but you don't see it. I mean, even when under normal circumstances, you're just not you just are not going to see it because there's not a lot of it, but it's there. But I think also, and this is the thing that I have observed, and that and 350 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But, you know, there's this idea of wari nihonjin, you know, we Japanese. And I don't know how to explain that, I mean, in a way. And I can tell you when you watch it with my SO, she is, I mean, very much on that. And she understands that. And to her, it's just a fact of life that, you know, she's Japanese and I'm not. And so, therefore, she is superior. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just to her, that's the order of the universe. That's the way she's brought up. And so I think there's a sense of that. I think she's written a lot about it on her Facebook page about, you know, how she's just proud to be Japanese because of what has happened as far as things being orderly and not, you know, there hasn't been a lot of that, you know, type of crime and everything else. And I think it's, you know, for everybody. Plus, again, too, you're not in the cities. You're in the countryside up there. So that's you know, those are different kind of people. And they're very family-oriented, and they're very, you know, good, honest people, hardworking people. That's my observation, anyway.
How much does the Japanese issue, or actually an Asian issue of face, come into this? Are they, have they been reluctant to expose problems in their, and if there have been problems with their infrastructure as far as disaster relief, or with respect to these power plants? Is that a cultural thing, or are we actually getting a pretty straight, in your view, a pretty straight view of what actually is happening?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, you know, there is the tatamai and the honmai, which is, you know, your true feelings versus your kind of your public persona. And but the thing too is, you know, in Japan, my observation was they don't have as much. I mean, their elections can be pretty unruly, but they don't attack the government as much as, say, we do. That they, you know, we're used to that kind of thing. We're used to fault finding. I think that, I think you've seen, you know, with Tokyo Electric Power Company, they weren't as forthcoming as they probably could have been early on. But that was also because that's kind of what they, you know, they're expect, they're trying to, you know, all deal with the problem, but also not kind of open up and not, you know, make a big spectacle of it. They want people to trust what they're saying. And could they have, I think in hindsight, they could have been more forthcoming earlier and it would have been helpful. I mean, especially asking for help earlier. But I do think there's an issue there. I mean, that's just not in there. You know, they're proud of what they do and they're proud of what they are. And so they don't want to ask for help unless they have to. And so I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, it does come into play. But, you know, it's kind of that way. You don't, like, for example, they don't negotiate directly. They're much more on, when the way they negotiate is to build consensus and come to things. And they don't like to confront people directly. It's just not the way that they do business.
The another thing that kind of got my attention, I got forwarded on from a forward of a forward, an email that was sent by the, I won't mention his name out there, but he's the new CTF 5772 P3 Admiral. P3 Admiral out there, and he was describing what, you know, some of the things that the P3 community is doing to help out the Japanese, and the Japanese self-defense forces, maritime and other. I mean, that's no small military, really, even though they don't spend a lot because of their constitution. They're very professional. You know, my first RIMPAC, when I interacted with them, I came away with a great amount of respect for, one, the way they maintain their ships or their aircraft. You know this better than I do. You talk to aviators. If your plane goes to a Japanese depot, you're happy when it comes back. But the U.S. military is doing a lot to help out the Japanese. And having spent so much time over there, both in and out of uniform, how would you describe that relationship between the Japanese military and the U.S. military, how the Japanese see that relationship? And have you seen it evolve in one direction or another in the last couple decades?
Well, I've always been impressed with them. I was lucky enough to be in a job. Hold on a second, I got to plug this thing back in.
Sure.
I was always lucky enough to be in a job where I could you know, work with them, both socially and professionally. And it, one of the things that if you saw or have seen some of the other stuff that 72 has put out, they've established a lot of common, they have a common watch floor now, and so they've done a lot of things with their P3 community. And so, you know, they're very professional, and they work really well. And I think what you're seeing is, at least what I've seen, you know, there's a lot of people coming down from Misawa to help out. And then I know, you know, they've been running Operation Tomodachi, which is people are actually meeting at the gym every day, and they're packing boxes and they're sending them out. And the, you know, HS-14 and HSL-51 have been flying relief missions from north. I don't know where they're staged now, though, but they're going. They came from Mitsugi and went up north. So, and I think that, you know, they're grateful to have the help. And I know that their own, you know, their own Navy has got is primarily their naval aviation is P3s, seaplanes, and helicopters. So they, I'm sure they're using them as well.
Yeah, it was my understanding they were using some of our decks for helicopter operations, and then we had also provided a ship that had loaded up some self-defense force trucks and equipment, and they were able to offload those at one of the crisis points for delivery. And I guess that, you know, they don't have that kind of indigenous capacity. They're not really an amphibious force, if I'm understanding correctly.
Well, yeah, and they've only just recently, they have what the, and I know Sal's familiar with it, they have a helicopter carrier, which they legally have to call a destroyer, although it's as big, it's much bigger than a destroyer. That's a relatively new ship that was in Yokosuka a few years back when I was over there. And I mean, and I know, so they've got that as decks, and then, of course, they have their other decks that they were working. But I'm sure, I wish I could actually... if I was at work, I could actually look at the laydown, and because I have been trying to follow that on the other side, you know, to look at what Seventh Fleet, look at the Seventh Fleet briefs each day. So it's interesting to watch, but of course I'm removed from it. I've been getting emails though that folks are there and they're working, and they're actually, what my one friend said is that, you know, they've had that voluntary evacuation of dependents. But most people, there are some who are taking it, but a lot of people aren't, and a lot of people aren't going to leave until, you know, until the last dog is hung.
Yeah, I read somewhere where they're not evacuating pets, and a couple people are like, I'm not leaving my dog behind. Another question I wanted to ask for you, you know, when you consider the fact that within living memory they had, you know, two of their major towns nuked, and rebuilt.
Yep.
There's probably few nations out there that at least intellectually is better prepared to talk about and respond or even have institutional knowledge of dealing with radiation, radiation poisoning, measuring what it actually impacts people. And Japan's, like France, has a significant portion of their energy derived from nuclear power because they have to. They don't have large amounts of natural resources. In the Japanese press, have they started a conversation about the future of nuclear power in Japan, or is it a settled issue, or is part of the Japanese culture something that they will focus on what needs to be done now, and then they will address that topic later?
I think your last answer is probably the closest. The problem is I haven't been able to read, especially this last week, I haven't been able to read a lot. But what I have seen and what got forwarded to me is they're not talking about it except in the real time news of what's happening. And as you pointed out, you know, they've got a hell of a hole in their electrical grid now, because there are, I know in Saitama, which is outside Tokyo, and over in Chiba, where the ESO still has an apartment over there, they've been having rolling power blackouts normally in the afternoons. Just to allow, you know, them to have enough electricity to you know, be able to do the things that they're going to need to do. So I think it's interesting, because there's a small group that raised a big, you know, a big stink when the George Washington came over. But but that all pretty much got settled. That was kind of the normal, you know, just the normal, we're going to make noise kind of thing. But they, most people kind of understood, and they knew what the need was. And, you know, they went and they built the new pier, and they did all the things that they needed to bring in George Washington over. So I think they're at peace with it, but they don't, you know, they're not going to talk about it outright the way we are. They're not going to, I don't think, make a knee-jerk reaction.
I was reviewing some of the stuff on your blog, and I guess some of it is your significant other's input. One of the things that struck me was the term earthquake cloud, which even as a former Californian, and I've never heard that term before. And then the other thing is that Japan is not a third world country, and are we seeing is some of the reason that we're not getting the horror stories that we might have gotten from Haiti or some other places because they're much more developed and are able to move stuff around despite these instances where they do have problems?
Well, I think so. I mean, for one thing, they've got a whole, you know, there's a whole logistics infrastructure. Most of the hoarding and everything that's going on is because people are buying things, but it's just, you know, they're trying to buy up the commodities so that what her mom said, for example, is that the biggest problem they have is fuel right now because they've got to husband it because the stations are only open at certain times. And that's because, you know, everything flows into the country from the ports, from Osaka, Tokyo, and then it's distributed. There's, you know, via the rail and also there's a pretty good overnight trucking system that you can get, like the Navy used it a lot. They'd be able to put parts on a truck overnight and have it down to Iwakuni or have it arrive the next morning. So I think that's part of it. I think that's one reason why I think you're going to see it's still tragic, but you're not seeing the level of devastation that you could have seen. And, you know, most of the damage came from the tsunami. It didn't come from the earthquake.
That's another thing that's, you know, interesting, that in a nation whose language gave birth to the word that describes it, tsunami, that there would be a nuclear plant that close to the shore. Because I've seen the same exact thing, that if there was no tsunami, there really wouldn't be any nuclear problem. I mean, the Japanese are actually, they and the GE engineers have continually talked about, this was designed for an 8.1. This was an 8.9 earthquake, which, because of all the logarithmic scale, I think that makes it 5 or 6 times, and 8.9 is 5 to 6 times stronger than what the design limitation is. But when you look around Japan, have they in the past engineered around the possibility of a tsunami, or was this tsunami so large that it was just beyond what they even planned? And has that conversation taken place in Japan as well?
Well, I think it's the latter. It was so big that they didn't, for one thing, they didn't have a lot of time for warning. I mean, when the tsunami warnings, you'd hear them in Yokosuka, and you'd hear the sirens go off, and they'd be really loud, and they'd give instructions on NHK, and they would do that, but they're predicated on much more warning time. And what I have read is some people only had as little as 9 minutes warning before the wave hit. And I think part of probably the location is, you know, they put it where they could get the available land without making a lot of, you got to realize, like, where the town is, they go further inland, you're going to get to more populated places. So it was probably one of those compromises they made to where they could get, you know, where they could get the land, where they could put it out. I don't know that for sure. That's just sheer speculation on my part. But again, too, I'm not so sure that you could see them build. I mean, you don't see a lot of seawalls, at least I didn't in my time. They were there, but they weren't. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily something you could, the earthquake you can build to and you can plan for, but the tsunami, especially because it covers such a large coastline there, there's really not a lot you can do, I think.
Yeah.
But they do have a good warning system.
Yeah, I think you were right. I too had heard that the metric they were using was they would have a half an hour warning on the tsunami, but as it turned out, they had less than 9 minutes, And you could tell if you're looking at the video on the internet, the number of cars riding along the highways and stuff. It's like, I don't know if those people were trying to get out of the way or were tourists or what, but kind of stunning to see traffic running on a highway where a huge wave is washing ashore.
Well, don't forget, too, it happened at 2:53 in the afternoon. I mean, it was the middle of the night our time, but it was in the early afternoon. Actually, in a way, it was a blessing because it hadn't happened before the traditional rush hour starts. You know, when you'd have, as it was, you had a lot of people in the train stations. And, you know, JR, my friends told me this, JR stopped running trains right away. So for the first 2 days at least, her sister could not, her sister actually had to walk from where she was working back to where they were living, which was about a 10-mile walk. Because the cars weren't running,
the
trains weren't running.
I've had some discussion with some people who were there who had to do the same thing. You know, they got separated. If they were in downtown Tokyo and they were staying on one of the outer areas, that they were pretty much forced to hunker down until they could get some kind of transportation to get back to where their home was. And of course, that creates additional panic and stress on the people because of the if your families are separated, your kids are in one place, and all the rest of it. But overall, the Japanese seem to have most of this pretty well organized.
You know, her sister works for the Tokyo Metropolitan Government, and that's what they did was they actually put them up in the building. I mean, they didn't have a lot to do that. They only had, you know, the regular, you know, stuff that was in the building. But they actually, they made them stay in the building until they had some idea of when the trains were going to start running and do those kind of things. So the first day it happened, she was like up, I think, on the 26th floor or whatever that building is. It's over in Shinjuku where her building is.
Well, and you know, you touched on this a little bit before, but there have been kind of conflicting reports on the logistics flow of food and you know, less so of the petroleum products, but have you heard any reports of areas that are just not getting food through to them, or seem to have been resolved?
You know what? I think I accidentally hung up on Skippy. We have a wardrobe malfunction.
That question will just hang out there in the air, I guess.
let me call him right back here. He's going to take it personally. So, you know, stuff like this that keeps you humble.
Hello.
Hey, that was all me, shipmate. That's my fault. I'm sorry. Do you want to finish up your question, Eagle One? Skippy, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, so anyway,
okay. My question is...
Go ahead.
Well, my question really had to do with the flow of logistics and whether you'd heard additional reports of people who hadn't gotten food or whether that had been resolved.
Everything I've heard is kind of concentrated on Sendai and Fukushima City, and then the other town, which I didn't know exactly where it is, Kesanuma, which is one of the coastal towns. I think it's south of Sendai. But as far as the rest of it, you know, there's still main arteries, main road arteries that can get up there. And so I'm sure they're using those, and they're moving what they can, and then augmenting it with. I don't know if the train service has started back to the north or not. That'd probably be a good thing to do. But you know, in normal times, their logistics system is phenomenal as far as getting stuff in the ports and getting it up to where it needs to be.
Well, Skippy, that has been a very fast half hour, and first of all, I want to thank you for finally coming on to Midrats and having a chance to talk to a while. It's good to have a chance because we've pretty much known each other for over half a decade. It's nice to be able to talk in person. And but if people want to read some more firsthand accounts, I know we've had a few people join us late. Your SO is reporting and you're commenting on her reports over at your blog, FareastCynic.com. And From her perspective, if there were somebody stateside who wanted to do something to help the Japanese people, is there something they could do that you think might be worth their time?
Well, I think obviously you can give the Japan Red Cross. I posted a link to that on my blog. I know there's also some of her friends have sent some links as far as where you can donate to. I think there is a way to do that. And CNFJ has posted it where you can help to donate things to Operation Tomodachi. Tomodachi means friend, by the way, in Japanese. And so that's why that's what they have been calling the relief effort, that the bases have been doing that. I mean, the families are donating rice cookers, crock pots, blankets, anything that they can do without, they've been donating and packing up and shipping up north. So that's, but as far as I think from stateside, probably the Japanese Red Cross is probably a good option. And there is a link to it. If you follow down one of my earlier posts, I've got a link to their website.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Skippy. We wish you the safe travels and look forward to an opportunity to talk to you again.
All right. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Skippy. And we'll be keeping your significant other's family and relatives in mind. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just as a quick reminder to those that might be joining us late, I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak, and that was our first guest, Skippy-san, from the blog FarEastCynic.com. Now let's go ahead and shift on over to our second guest. A good pivot. I know we have a lot of people in the audience here not only like books, but they like books that have a little bit of cheek to them. And our second guest today, he's got a long history at the Navy Marine Corps team. He, after completing officer training in Quantico, he served as an infantry platoon leader, and then he decided that he might want to look at dirt as opposed to play around in it. So way back in July of 58, after his 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines was ordered to Lebanon, he shifted over to naval flight training, where he became a naval aviator, Marine Corps style. Once he left the Corps, he flew for a few years for the Forest Service, then a rather well-mixed-up CV, 9 years with Honeywell Information Systems, and then in the mid-60s, he left Honeywell and began a computer software and consulting business, developing software for business clients and DOD. He still serves many of his old clients, and he enjoys writing for quite a few magazines. He put out his first book back in 2002 called A Few Good Memories, Tales from Marine Corps Boot Camp, and he's finishing up, and as I'm sure he'll back me up, I think it's going to be published this July and August, his next book, Getting Our Wings, Tales from Naval Aviation Flight School, which is going to take a lighter side view of flight training, much of the same way he did with boot camp with A Few Good Marines. Bob Taylor, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you, Commander. You did a beautiful job on that introduction.
Well, thank you, sir, very much. Had a good source material. Well, it's, you know, a lot of time when we're talking about military history, there are books that are just, you know, they can weigh on you because it's a serious business that we're in. But you've done something that has always been a great relief. And every time I run into people that I served with, somebody tells a story that I had completely forgotten about, and I got tears coming out of my eyes. I'm doubled over laughing because in a job like ours with a lot of stress, there's also a lot of great people and great stories. And before we talk a bit about your book about the Tales of Aviation Flight School, tell us what gave you the idea to do your first book, A Few Good Marines, Tales from Marine Corps Boot Camp.
Well, Sal, I got the idea because I have a good friend in my little town here of Cairo, Georgia, and he told me a few stories that he had when he was in boot camp, and I remember I went to boot camp before I went into Quantico, and there were things. I mean, they weren't too funny then, but I don't know, somehow I just got the idea, you know, if you put these all together, you could tell the story of boot camp, the nuts and bolts of boot camp, but you could also let the stories drive the book, and that's what I tried to do.
Who did you originally? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eagle One.
Bob, this is Eagle One. I had a chance to look at your website. Yeah, I had a chance to check your website, and unfortunately for me, unfinished stories. But the samples you have on your website of the episodes are not the complete stories. I gather. I gather.
Oh,
the rest
no,
of an
sir.
I'm going to have to spring for your book.
One of these days, when I finish it all, I will put some complete stories out there. That's right. It's unbelievable what some of these people did while they were going through flight school. You know, they just gave up, I think, some of them, Eagle, because it was pretty tough, and like everything in the military is tough. It's supposed to be, and I hope it is always tough. But that was, it was just so funny, some of those stories.
When you went through in 1958, please, that'd be great if you did. That's about the same time that former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld went through flight school. You didn't happen to run into him or remember him from back then, do you?
No, but as I understand from somebody, he was just ahead of me, and I think he was leading the way. but we were there at the same time. And I don't think any of the stories that I have are about Mr. Rumsfeld.
Really, cannot confirm or deny.
No, sir, I can't.
Eagle One.
Well, there's some discussion on our chat room about exactly where your accent is from. What part of the South did you grow up in?
Let me tell you, I came from a dairy farm in Georgia, and I jumped from there into boot camp. So you see that they never let me really lose that accent. And of course, I married a wife that even has a deeper accent than I do. And like when she was going to Florida State, they told her that she could get a teaching certificate, if she promised never to teach in Florida. So you see where I'm from, Eagle.
Well, that's funny. Is you mentioned, I think it used to be on one of the water towers there, I think, but it used to describe Pensacola as the mother-in-law to naval aviation or something to that respect.
Now, I don't remember that, but
but there are a lot of people who go to Pensacola flight school, and even some of those that have non-Southern accents who do wind up finding their partners for life there. How many of those stories that do you have involve people in their finding a partner, so to speak?
I only have one. I only have one there. Most of the stories that I have are actually happened in the air, such as Eagle. You might have seen that one about the Sperling, and that's not his real name, and I wouldn't dare put his real name out, but the guy that knew he was toast and he would soon be out of the flight program, and that's when he decided to bomb the towers at Cantonment. If you know Pensacola, there's a big factory up north of Pensacola, and he tried to bomb it with a sack of flour. He missed, of course, and hit a automobile and destroyed the windshield. But I don't have but one story, and that this guy was a good friend of mine, and he always was. It's not that an elaborate story, but that I have it in there anyway.
Well, I'm familiar with the plant. My parents retired to Pensacola, lived there for quite a long time. So, in fact, over there by the University of West Florida, which is right near that plant. So, of the stories that you've got in here, what do you have? Some particular favorites? Or do you just enjoy all the ones you put down? How did you decide what to put in the book?
I'm glad this one will certainly be in there. And this one, Eagle, happened to me. I was just back from Lebanon, and I had like 16 days or so to finish up reapplying for flight school, taking the physical, and getting orders to Pensacola. And, of course, you know how the grunts, the Marine grunts are. They don't like aviators. And I had a hard time pushing past these people to go ahead and get my orders. Well, we got to Pensacola, and we drove all Christmas Day to get there. And we checked into a motel. And we decided, okay, we had to. It's Christmas dinner. We had to get Christmas dinner someplace. Well, we started looking around for some restaurant, and lo and behold, in the little city of Warrenton, there one was. And we stopped, got out of the car, and walked up to the door, and we saw people there, fantastic people there. Walked up to the door, and it said, family dinner. And we both said, I guess we'll have to go to a service station and get a candy bar. But this lady came to the door, and she says, I see your uniform, and I realize that you probably are looking for Christmas dinner. Come in and enjoy ours with us. And that was the feeling we had for nearly 2 years while in Pensacola. It was the greatest town for the military-civilian relationship. And we went back to that motel, that restaurant, several times. Our daughter was born there, and it was just a fantastic event to take place. And I think that's what Pensacola is famous for in the military right now.
It does have that reputation as being such a welcoming town. And I also noticed on your website, one of the things you're asking for, you mentioned the Dilbert Dunker and the stories that involve water and the pool and everything else. And that's one thing that, you know, those who grew up near the ocean or grew up in a part of the country where it's actually warm enough 9 months out of the year, you can swim if you want to. But there's large parts of this country that people just plain do not know how to swim. And a friend of mine loved to tell a story when he was going through flight school that there was this, never want to see a grown man cry, but there was this big, big guy. He was a linebacker for the Naval Academy who was sitting up at the top of the tower that he had to jump in tears. Guy could not swim. He had been a remedial swimming. He was actually horrified of the tower. How many of your stories do you have coming in involve people trying to overcome their fears, like a lot of people have the fear of the water?
You know, unfortunately, I have one story, and that is a guy who all of his pre-flight grades were so good. He was highly, his aptitude was extremely good. He got up on that tower in pre-flight. He could not go, and they let him off, and they let him out, and they put him back in the water and 2 weeks later they brought him in. He never made it, but that was a requirement, and it was really sad. When he wrote that story to me, I just said, I feel for you, buddy, but it was a requirement that the Navy had, and it was well-founded.
Absolutely. Eagle One.
Well, I have a son who went through flight school fairly recently. Of course, that's like 10 years ago now, but it's all recent to me. I don't remember any of these great stories coming out of that, and I don't know if flight school has changed significantly. Are most of your stories from many years ago, or do you have some contemporary stories sneaking in too?
No, I have some contemporary stories, but it seems to me that the ones I'm getting most of are the ones that were like from about 1950 prior to 1970, and I am really looking for stories that cover the whole time, you know. I think maybe that these people realize maybe that they can no longer be given captain's mast if they tell the story at this late date. But that I just need stories from everywhere, and I've got a lot. I really do, and people have been very kind. And my theory on these stories, I don't want to make jokes about people, you know, but I'm writing the history of naval aviation, and there's so much there. You know, you have your first aviators like Ellison and Rogers and Towers and Softley, and of course, they were the ones that led into this thing. And I've got plenty of stories about bad times back there. But I just need to cover the 1980s through to 2000s with more stories.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing that you're doing. Yeah, there's places like that. The U.S. Naval Institute has been working real hard to get an oral history program going. But mm-hmm. you know, whether it's an oral history or it's a written history, history that's not recorded never happens. And I think some of it might have to do with the fact that, like some of my father's friends in their later years, is a lot of people when they're young, even some older people, they think they're immortal, that death is for other people. And when you reach a certain age and you start to realize, you know, well, hey, maybe I'm not mortal, and if I don't tell these stories, nobody will know them. And I think that's one of the great things about your book. It's always good to laugh, but it's also good to record that. And because you're starting to accumulate this and you're talking to people, for reasons best not discussed in proper company, but recently there's been a lot of discussions about the aviator culture and the personalities in naval aviation, especially carrier aviation, and it's sharp elbows, it's a little bit ribald point of
right.
view. But there's a reason for that. There's probably also a reason why nobody's ever going to publish a Freudian slip there. No one is ever going to publish, Eagle One, forgive me, a book of funny SWO stories. I'm sorry, surface stuff that have the service warriors is just not funny. It's something people go to therapy for years about. But what is it about the naval aviation, which includes the Marine Corps, of course, that personality that is such a fertile ground for stories that usually come from those personalities?
You know, I really don't know what it is, except that the people that have sent me stories, and I just received early this morning, before I went to church, an email from a guy who says, "Would you promise not to repeat my name, and I will send you a great story?" And I said, "Absolutely." I don't know whether that's what it is or not. But I do know this, that the people that I have received it for are proud to submit these stories. If I were a psychologist, I might be able to answer your question. But I just think that they want to get involved in this book. And going back a little bit to what you said. History. I don't know whether you know Doug Kirkland. He was a former naval aviator, retired as a captain. He and I are good friends because our wives were high school classmates. But he is one who's we talked the other day about how ridiculous it is not to have a really full history of different parts, and that's what I am accomplishing with this. And you mentioned, Sal, about the the time that the book will be published. But what I'm saying is, if it takes another 2 months, another 3 months, another 4 months, I don't mind waiting because I want to get it complete. And I think, I'll tell you, here's another kudo for the Navy. Of course, I had to go before PAO in New York to get the opportunity to for the Navy's help. And when I went, I got that. It took ages to do that. But I took my letter to Pensacola, and I got with the PAO people on NAS Pensacola, who I met a few times with them, and then they sent me to PAO Milton, which is NAS Whiting. And they have been the most gracious people in the world. They, you know, I want pictures, they get pictures. I've got Dilbert Duncan pictures I was not able to find anywhere. They want to see a history as complete as can be, and I want to give it to them.
Well, that is great to hear, because you know, the PAOs sometimes give a little bit of grief. I know I've given them in the past, but mm-hmm. I think what it sounds like, you finally talked to the right one who gets it, because not only is history is something, it's one of my hobby horses, that without a deep and broad understanding of history and the profession of arms, you're blind, you're unrooted. You're going to get yourself and the people, especially as an officer, and the people whose lives are in your charge, you're going to get them in trouble. And some of that is the funny parts of history, but even the funny stuff has important stuff to say. Eagle One.
Yeah, did you have you gotten any stories from the instructor pilots dealing with some of these people and their most terrifying moments or some of their funny stories?
Well, Eagle, strange you should say. Let me tell you about one. And these are two Marines. One was a Marine, you know, and we're a little bit lacking in intelligence, as most people think. But this instructor was a Marine. This student was a Marine. And they became pretty good buddies, which you're not supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to maintain that rapport. But the student said, "Sir, I'd like to take you on a little trip today." They were at Pensacola, and he says, "I'm headed for Fairhope," and that's over to Mobile, toward Mobile. And he went to Fairhope, and he went out over Mobile Bay, and he headed south, and he got below Fairhope about 15 or 20 miles, and he said, "Okay, we're going to turn," and the instructor says, "Where are we going?" Well, he got there, and he went, he was very low to the deck. He raised up, and over the hedgerow he went, and there was the nudist colony. the instructor writing that story says, "I learned never to be taken over by a student again." But that one's in the book.
Have you had a chance, guy? We've got to find some way to get word out. But also, one thing they do at Pensacola is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps instructor pilots train a lot of foreign students,
yes.
And that's everybody from the occasional Italian to the Saudi and everything in between. And there's got to be a huge culture shock, not just for those student aviators, but also for the instructors that have to work with them. Have you had any stories like that, or is that something you just need to get the word out some more to maybe get some people to bring them in?
Well, on my next trip to Pensacola, I have interviews with a number of instructors. And I have asked the PAO people to get a lot of the foreign instructors who taught foreign students. So I'm going to cover that one probably in the next 2 weeks.
Beautiful.
having been a SWO, and apparently, according to Sal, causes brain damage.
No, psychological problems.
Or psychosis or something. The only time I really had much interface with aviators was, you know, landing them on the Gila deck or at the QBO club in the Philippines, which I gather is outside the scope of your book. But
yes.
You know, speaking of Dilbert Dunkers, they have their own device out there. Do you cover any of that stuff? Any exciting stuff that happened in the fleet that we probably can no longer do without getting reprimanded and thrown out of the Navy?
Now, I do have some Dilbert Dunker stuff, but this new stuff, of course, is foreign to me. And once you graduate from flight school, like you say, the scope is finished. But I do know this, at Whidbey Island, they've got a complete medical and, what do they call it, aviation medicine laboratory up there. They have one of the new Dilbert Dunkers. But you see, that's far past from beyond my time. But the answer to your question is not really.
The Dilbert Dunker isn't so terrifying as, and there are lots of SWOs who have to go through this. And if you want to spend any time on helicopters around ships, and that's that, whatever you call it, that horrendous metal tube, they strap you in, blindfold you, put you in the water, turn you upside down. That's enough to drive anybody out. When you think of naval aviation and you're trying to find who are our high-profile aviators, have you had a chance to reach out to Senator John McCain? Because what little birdies have told me, he has some great stories. A couple could probably be published, Eddie. And has he had a chance to maybe touch base with him or some of the other high-profile naval aviators out there if they wanted to contribute?
I will do that tomorrow. I will write Senator McCain a letter, and that is perfect. You are absolutely right. And who knows? Every time you get a new angle, then there are probably two or three angles that emanate from that. So maybe that will work. As I say, this book is not too far started yet, but I'm hoping to finish it in August or September, but I don't have to. But that's a good idea. I will definitely do that.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I was just thinking on the excitement of naval aviation. Part of the fun as a parent is going down to the winging ceremony and all that. And I've always wondered if there have been some great stories that have come out of some of those winging things. I mean, have you touched on any of those things? Have anybody share moments out of that?
I have not. It might be, you know, something to prompt from people. But no, I have an Eagle.
Well, I'll tell you, we're down to 1 minute left, and I just want to take a minute to see, you know, what we can do to help and help get out and push, so to speak. Is Bob is still taking stories for his book, and a lot of our listeners, I know, they know aviators or their parents do that have stories that's left everybody in stitches. Head on over to his website. We're gonna have we got links to it over at my home blog. And you can also go up on Amazon and find everything you need to know there about his previous book, A Few Good Marines, Tell for Marine Corps Boot Camps, www.gettingourwings.com, to help him, you know, get as many good stories as he can together for Getting Our Wings, Tales from Naval Aviation Flight School. Mr. Bob Taylor, thank you very much for coming on MidRats. And enjoy the springtime, and good luck with getting all the stories you need.
Thank you both, and I enjoyed it so much.
Well, thank you, Bob. I look forward to seeing your book.
Okay. I will send you one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks, everybody, for taking time out of the news of Libya and basketball and everything else. Appreciate you joining us today. Make sure and join us again next week for another edition of MidRats. Thanks, everybody, and have a great Navy Day.
Yeah.